Pushing Faders in association with SVG Europe Audio.
Hello and welcome to Pushing Faders, the broadcast sound podcast. I'm a slightly busy lad this week, so I'm having to record the intros and outros in my car on the way to Nottingham. But as ever, thanks to everybody who listened to the podcast. I think we're about to tip over like 4,500 listens, which is absolutely amazing. And as I always say, thanks to everybody who sends me a message, let me know what you think of the podcast. Been getting quite a few this last couple of weeks, so that's been great. On this week's show, and as I mentioned in the last episode, joining me for a chat is Nigel Heath. Nigel is a multiple BAFTA award winning and Emmy nominated re-recording mixer with credits such as Killing Eve, Downton Abbey, Four Lions, Shaun of the Dead, The Girl with the Pearl Earring, it goes on. The list goes on of things Nigel's worked on. But I originally got in touch with Nigel after hearing his name pop up on the Rule of Three podcast in an episode with Nish Kumar. Now, the Rule of Three podcast is a comedy podcast where comedians go on there to talk about their favourite sitcom, film, stand-up show, anything like that. And Nish went on there to talk about Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, which Nigel worked on. And during the podcast, Nish actually mentions Nigel and some of the work that he did on the show. So it gave me the idea to give Nigel a shout to see if he wanted to talk to me. Garth Marenghi's Dark Place is a surreal 2004 comedy series written and directed by Richard Ayoade and Matthew Holness. And it also features like the who's who of comedy around that time. The Mighty Boosh guys pop up in it. Stephen Merchant, who went on to star with Ricky Gervais, he's in there. Just loads and loads of people. It also features very early in his career, Matt Berry. And the production on it's really bad, but on purpose. And that's the thing I wanted to talk to Nigel about. I have rattled on quite a bit for this one today, but it is only a short podcast because Nigel's a very busy man and couldn't talk to me for very long. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. And if you do get a chance, go and have a look at Dark Place and also check out some of the stuff that Nigel's worked on. So thank you for joining me, Nigel. It's great to have you. I think you're one of the first people that I got in touch with when I first got the idea for the podcast. So it's a pleasure to have you on.
Nice to be here.
So as with everybody, I always go into how you were working in audio and what sort of drove you to that that career path. So if you could just give us a bit of a brief rundown of your career and how you got into it.
Yeah, I mean, my career goes back ages because I'm so old. And also I started when I was like 13 on a community radio station in Hereford, which is in the West Midlands. After being told, or around about the time that my careers teacher, when they asked me what I wanted to do, I said, I want to do radio and I want to do jingles and I want to produce things and make sounds. And they said, oh, that's just a bit over the top. You know, why don't you think about consider the SAS? And with the greatest will in the world, it wouldn't have been a perfect match. So I went to radio and did that for a while and loved it and made me do really badly at school because I was just so focused on music and sound and, you know, breaking up bits of tape. My mum and dad got me one of those Grundig tape recorders, those old things that you see in charity shops sometimes, yeah. You know, and a reel-to-reel machine. And I got into, you know, recording through the back of the tape to make someone sound like they were behind the door. When actually I could have just gone behind the door and recorded it. I just thought that just now, actually. And stuff like that. So doing things practically.
Yeah.
Which actually fed into my work with people like Chris Morris, Richard Ayoade, and Matt Holness, where on their shows, which we may talk about in a bit, I guess, we do a lot of things practically.
Yeah.
You know, more on that later. But, so I was down in Hereford, but it was kind of an area at the time when local radio and stuff didn't have its presence that it has now, which is it's now an amazing asset for UK broadcasting. But at the time, you know, there wasn't much around. So mum and dad, God bless them, made the decision to move from the West Midlands to London, which was the hub of where things were at. And I look at that and look back on that and I think, wow, what a gesture that was to kind of give me a chance. And,
yeah.
You know, they left their family behind and it was a big, big thing for them to do. And I still, they're no longer with us, but when I was blessed to get my first BAFTA, they were the people I spoke about, and I thanked them. Mm. And then got a telling off from somebody for not thanking the production company. But, you know, there you are. That's life.
They get thanked enough on these things.
They get enough thanks, and they do well enough. But I moved to London and with my parents and wrote about 100 letters to music publishing companies and recording studios and radio stations. And I got a job with one of the last letters that I wrote. Got a job at a music publishing company in Soho, and worked in their sound transfer department, copying masters and making safety copies and cutting down 3-minute tracks to make 28-second versions for use in commercials, which kind of led back to what I was doing on the radio station, you know, making jingle packages and stuff. Mm. So that was pretty handy, and I really enjoyed it there. And also got to work in their recording studio. They had a 16-track soundtracks room at the publishing company, and they also had a big studio in North London with a massive Neve and a big couple of rooms and state of the art. And it was nice. And I was well mentored there and taught and learned lots of stuff, which was great. And again, you know, a thing I'm passionate about is mentoring and teaching. And I was very blessed to probably be one of the last generation of my generation to be in an environment where you were severely mentored and looked after, and not severely, but, you know, seriously so. Mm. And taught everything from how to behave in studios to how to be comfortable with the clients. If you go for lunch with a band, if you go for dinner, night out, how to deal with it, how to deal with the circumstances. And, you know, I was very well taught and blessed with that. Mm. And then through a bit of good fortune and doing some decent work at home, I set up my own company with a guy called Steve Felton, who worked with me in the transfer department in the publishing company. And we started a company called Hackenbacker, which did okay and did well until, unfortunately, COVID took us out. Because all the work moved out of town, out of our lives. And I had to kind of work for somebody else for a while, which was fine, and they looked after me, and I'm very grateful for that. But now I'm back on my own again with my team, and working out of a place that we rent a space out of British Grove Studios, which is lovely, and then we also work in other places. We had a small studio and a transfer bay of our own, specializing in working with film and time code at the time. That was a very modern thing to be doing, and we had a printer that would physically print the time code on the back of white 16mm film, magnetic film, so the editors could see the camera time code printed on the back of the 16mm mag to sync it up. And we were one of the first transfer bays in London to do that. Cool. It was a breakthrough at the time. And I'd mix rushes in our little studio for screenings and such, and then organically just moved over to mixing programs and films. And then we upgraded the studio, and I started mixing things like Chris Morris, a show called The Day to Day, and Brass Eye for Chris, Jam, Nathan Barley. And then we moved studios a couple more times and ended up with a really lovely Dolby room, with a gorgeous custom-made Neve MMC and films like Girl with a Pearl Earring, nice. Shaun of the Dead, Dead Man's Shoes, The Descent, Hot Fuzz in Bruges, that kind of stuff. The double, Downton Abbey came later, Death of Stalin, Sparks Brothers. And yeah, it was a very natural progression, and towards the middle bit, it was quite rapid.
Mm. So what would you say?
But I got away with it, Chris. I got away with it.
Well, I mean, I think that's what most people in TV feel like they do. They get away with it all their life because it doesn't feel like you're doing a job most of the time, does it? You're doing more of a hobby. So what would you say your primary role in TV audio is at the moment?
I guess my main focus is to keep everything tidy, nice, and well balanced. Mm. There's a trend, as we all know, you know, there's lots of moaning about it on social media, where, you know, I can't hear the dialogue and this and that and that. And in my opinion, and, you know, there's a limit to how natural things can be. In a very unnatural, you're doing a very unnatural thing. You're taking a scene of something and you're squeezing it through a small loudspeaker, which isn't natural. So we need to help it. We need to coax it through. And I think we have to, part of a role as a mixer is to protect the director's vision and enable them to do what they wish and to convey what the actors have been directed to do, but also to coax it through the screen and make sure that people aren't disappointed that they can't hear the words or the story, or that they're not going to be, you know, pissed off by you know, a minute of low-level dialogue, and then suddenly there's a massive music cue, and they reach for their, you know, reach for the remote controls, which is a thing that, you know, people don't like to do.
Yeah, it seems to be becoming more of a thing that in the last sort of 10 years or so, where you're getting more and more of these programs where they sort of dramatically keep it quiet and then suddenly blast your ears off, and I don't know where that's come from.
Maybe from the use of average levels, you know, average level metering and QCs, you know, back in the day of pieces of metal moving in a PPM, you know, you'd keep it, you'd peak at 6 and you'd keep it bobbing at around 4.5, 5. Yeah. Now you can go down to, you know, you can have a minute on PPM 3. Don't shoot me down if I get the numbers wrong, chat. But, you know what I mean? You can pretty much do pretty much kind of what you want. Is that useful? I'm not sure.
It's just one of those things.
That's another story.
I mean, even in the live stuff I do, it's become a thing that we have to adhere to, and I don't quite understand it fully. It's just one of those things that we have to do now.
Yeah.
But obviously,
but it does give you foot room that you maybe wouldn't have used before. You know.
Yeah. But yeah. So you've mentioned before quite a lot of big productions through your career. The first thing I got in touch with you about was your work on Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. Now,
yes,
which I think considering that because you had a BAFTA for Downton, I'm right in saying that, aren't I?
Yeah.
Now this is sort of like taking a step back to something quite random, but it's just one of those TV shows where it is so bad it's good. And that's the intention behind it. How did you get involved with that?
I'm just trying to think. I think it came through my connection with Chris Morris. I think Richard Ayoade and Matt, it ended up with me because Chris might have said some kind things.
Hmm.
Again, through the use of doing things practically.
Hmm.
I remember when, and I be careful how I quote Chris here because I don't tend to quote him, but... We did something. He came to me to interview me for the day to day, I think, and it was like, how would you go about making this piece of tape sounded like it had been put into the gutter and pissed on?
Mm.
And I said, well, I'd probably take it into the gutter and have it and wee on it.
Yeah,
and that's true. That's what the question was, because at the time the world was obsessed, and I was slightly obsessed with Fairlights and Synclaviers, and you know, you could feed something into the Fairlight and muck it up, you know, and do things. But we just wanted to try something. Well, you know, at that time I didn't have one, so that wasn't an option.
Mm.
But it was refreshing to give a genuine answer.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you want me to sound like that's been peed on? I'll go and pee on it, Chris. and it amused him, you know.
Yeah.
I think, and you know, we're still in contact. And, you know, he's one of my favorite people to work with. And I think that's how we got Garth Marenghi. I think it came via Richard asking Chris. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think that's how that happened. And it was brilliant. It was brilliantly shot. They called on all the departments, props, lighting, location, sound, to do what was right for the show, which is not easy. It is not easy to do things in the way that show needed it.
No, because it feels like it could have taken forever to make with all of like the cuts, you know, the close-ups that are then overdubbed, and yeah, it feels like there was a lot of work went into it.
Yeah, and visually, you know, there was boom shadows that, you know, are normally obviously avoided.
Mm.
But yeah, I think there's one occasion where a character just starts to whisper really quietly, you know, it's like whatever, and you see the boom, the shadow, as the operator just desperately tries to get closer to get something up for the feed, you know, and then they go, but, and up goes the, and I think we put a sound effect of the boom, of a boom, you know, rattle up the pole. So there was lots of that going on the shoot. And then in post, we had a lot of fun with it, but it was very serious fun. It is... The analogy is, you know, Les Dawson on that, you know, his brilliant bad piano playing. You've got to know how to play the piano to do that. And yeah, it was a lot of work, but it was huge fun.
Did they have much of an idea of how they wanted to
yes.
do it, or did and so give you the freedom to? We want to do this. Could you make this happen?
Yeah, exactly that. They knew the result they wanted, But obviously you wouldn't expect them to know that to make the title music sound that way, you'd record it Dolby A and play it back without the Dolbys in.
Mm.
And then, you know, chew the tape, which the title music was chewed by yours truly.
What, did you literally chew the tape?
I literally chewed the tape, yeah, to get stereo dropouts that did that wonderful jumping from side to side thing.
Right.
In fact, the Channel 4 commissioning editor, I think, came to visit us on the afternoon where I'd been chewing tape, and I think I had this disgusting brown binder around my lips. And Richard announced that, oh, Nigel's just been chewing the title sequence. And she looked and like, yes. Pass. It looked odd. But, you know, great Andrew Hewitt, great music score, great use of synths.
Yeah.
That were a little bit, you know, out there, but worked great for the show.
I'm right. I think the guy did the score was, did a lot of classical stuff. Or like, yes. Yeah. And then he sort of did this as a bit of a, I can't remember what they said on the podcast now, but it was like he was, well, obviously into it, like in the same way you were, that it was the chance to do something totally off.
Yeah.
Off his normal sort of thing.
Another thing that we did on the show was record it. The whole mix went out to time code, center track time coded quarter inch, non-Dolby, 7.5, or was it 15 or 7? I can't remember, but incredibly loudly recorded. So it was a big operating level on it.
Mm.
And then I stored the tapes front out for a couple of days in a warm place. And then we took them from that. We transcribed, we played them out into audio file, and it had genuine print through, genuine. Da, 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 da. And I had a broadcast, a transmission engineer friend of mine said, he said, I watched that Dark Place guy. He said, the print through on the Channel 4 logo was absolutely perfect because you get that pre-echo thing happening, you know?
Yeah.
So it's all a bit geeky, but, you know, good experience. And people love it. People still love it.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that it was the 20th anniversary of the first episode on Friday. Just gone.
Yeah.
It's one of those TV shows that nobody can really place in time as well, because I've talked to a few people about it and they said, it's mid-90s, isn't it? And I was like, I think it's probably early 2000s. But yeah. Obviously 2004, which it seems earlier than that, but I guess that's just how it looks earlier than that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it plays with your mind.
Yeah, and like, I think when I spoke to you on the phone that you were saying that the all the characters had their own sort of backstory about how they would like redo their dubbing. So like, obviously Matt Berry's character is literally all overdubbed from what I can tell.
Yeah, we worked out, so that there was a reason for it. We worked out that one of the characters, I think it might have been Richard's character. No, was it Matt's? It was Matt's character who had a rustly coat, a bit like Columbo's Mac.
Yeah.
And I think Peter Falk didn't like doing ADR. There was some story that Matt and Richard would tell. So we invented this scenario that when there were big moves or he was running, we would have to ADR it because of the noise from the coat. And it gave it a reason to have ADR in the places that we had it rather than just randomly doing things.
Yeah.
And Richard's, there was another conceit with Richard and Matt. We just made a conceit up that, you know, he had to do ADR for technical reasons, but he was terrible at it. And also the studio that he worked in only had an SM58 handheld that Matt would hold like a kind of, you know, like a pop singer.
Yeah.
So it was just the worst recorded ADR you could ever imagine. And he wasn't very good at it, which kind of built this voice character thing that is kind of very boomy and very, you know, I won't attempt to do it in case Matt's listening. But it was fun. It was fun to do. But to keep it again, to have a sense of some form of reality within its own world, we did invent little scenarios that kind of make sense.
Mm. I mean, that's even going even deeper, I guess, into like a production role, into where you sort of give in characters within the film, characters within the characters of the, because they're all playing two characters, aren't they, themselves, and then the fake TV show character. Giving them a backstory as well is just another depth of bizarreness to it all.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I saw the thing with the chase scene between Garth and Noel Fielding where they're on the bikes and it's all like motorbike noises, but they're on like old pedal choppers.
I think that's an episode called The Apes of Wrath. Yeah, brilliant, and lots of tape echo and spin echo, and you know,
is it nice to work on projects like that are just, you know, if you're doing your serious bits and pieces like Downton or whatever, but looking back and thinking I've done something where it's been a bit more fun and
yeah, well, Downton is fun, but this is fun in a different way. You know, you're going for belly laughs in the mix.
Yes, that's what I mean. Sorry, you're targeting what you're doing as you're creating your own sort of comedy to it, aren't you? I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was nice because the soundtrack, you know, was its own piece of comedy in that as well, and that's very much down to Richard and Matt who really know what they're doing. You know,
did you say you'd done something with you put the stereos the wrong way round on one of the episodes or something as well?
Yes, that was fun. We re-recorded it out with the left and rights reversed and did some very obvious panning, and then we did a preview. I think a press preview or press show, and very kindly the projectionist had heard in the screening rehearsal that I had the stereo around the wrong way, so he reversed the plugs on the Digibeta playout, and just before the curtain went up, he said, "Don't worry," he said, "I've put your stereo right for you," and very well meaning, yeah. But. Blew one of the gags, really.
It's almost like he's saying that you didn't know what you were doing there by swapping it back round.
Well, there you go.
It's that's great because it's like it's one of those cult TV shows that sort of everybody's heard of but not everybody's watched. But then you sort of tell people to watch it and then they come back and like, oh, that's fantastic.
It's worth a look. It's still on. It's still on Channel 4.
Yeah,
More 4, isn't it? All 4, whatever.
I rewatched it in October, November time, and it's just
yeah.
I think even things like the opening scene where. I can't remember the female character's name now, but she,
Liz.
She's walking through the hospital at the beginning, and the footsteps don't match what she's doing. And then
our Foley team did the Foley live without having seen the scenes.
Right.
So they came into our studio, and we laid out shoes, guns, in the order they'd be needed. So it wasn't totally unfair.
Yeah.
But we didn't. Let them see it. So we recorded it live and then moved it all earlier by, I don't know, 3 frames just to save their embarrassment a little bit.
Yeah.
But it is like, there's a moment where there's a cat thrown out of a cupboard, out of a door, and it lands. I mean, how she got it in the way that she did at all is amazing.
Yeah. Cause the cat just, you see the person's hand throw the cat out of the door as well. Yes.
Oh. And I think the cat then talks.
I think it's telepathy. Yeah, it says it says something ridiculous.
Just leave.
It's Matt Berry's voice.
It's Matt Berry's voice with a lot of tape echo.
Yeah, it's Matt Berry who then is the next person in shot, which is crazy.
Yeah.
So going on to think other bits and pieces you've worked on then. So what was your role on Downton?
Mixer and. Trying to make it sound not like a typical period drama. It's a very bright and lively mix. The music, John Lunn is superb. John's music team are brilliant. And it was really nice to make a vibrant sounding period drama. I don't know what we did that's different than a regular period drama, but we did something. And again, it was probably the music compositions as well really, really helped.
Yeah.
You know, move it along. And there's a very lovely thing that John does is that he doesn't tend to, or doesn't actually, preempt the emotion of what the actors are going to do. So it's like the actors get to do it first and then John comes in rather than, John doesn't signpost stuff. And that's a very nice thing for a mixer because you can then, I don't know, it just gives you another level of manipulation emotionally and technically and creatively, and it's a lovely project. It's a lovely show to work on. I've done all the TV episodes and both movies.
The second film is one of the characters become an actress, but she can't. She hasn't got the voice for TV.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so there's a slightly manic sound person in there going, "I need quiet. I need quiet." And various things that I hope. Isn't based on anything that the production team have heard me do in their ADR sessions.
So I spoke to Ollie from Red TX last week, and he'd mentioned that he'd worked on Downton with you.
Yeah, they did some great location ADR recording, I think at Alnwick Castle. Mm. Sounded really good, and it was great to have the actors, you know, walk off the set or the location into a very nicely prepared mobile setup. And yeah, it was great because the actors are so much in character. You know, they've just literally, you know, 10 minutes before been in front of the cameras. Mm. And that's the first time I've used location ADR in that way, and it was very successful, and they did a brilliant job.
Yeah, it's funny with this podcast because I keep recording with people, and there seems to be like a connection to one of the next episodes I'm trying to put together. So I spoke to Tudor Davies, who does Jules Holland, a couple of weeks ago, and he'd worked with Red TX, and I spoke to obviously Ollie at Red TX, and then he'd mentioned that he'd worked with you. So it was like becoming like a little chain of connections between everybody who seems to be working with each other.
Yeah, that's great.
It's just a tight little industry, isn't it? The old TV world. So it's just one of those things where we all seem to be intertwined in some respect.
Yeah, it's good. It's very good. Excuse the sirens. If you can hear any sirens, by the way, I'm not in my studio. Don't panic.
It's fine.
I'm in the company apartment.
All right. That's not a problem. Which is, I run them through a noise cancelling thing anyway, because I've done some episodes where I've had builders next door, which was fun to deal with.
And question, do you leave this stuff in, what we're talking about now, so that your sound audience can appreciate it?
I'll leave bits and pieces in. Sometimes when we go off on tangents, I end up having to chop them back to make it make sense a little bit. But yeah.
Yeah, okay.
With Downs, were you the mixer for the whole thing then?
Yes. Yeah, so I did the post-production mixer on the TV shows and the films. And it's great. I've got a very good relationship with the composer, with John. So I kind of, sixth sense tells me what he's going to do, and he has a sixth sense that he'll have a guess of what I'll try to do with the scene. And it's absolutely brilliant to have that, because we don't have to drop stuff to get John through. And, you know, it's good. Mm. I mix that show in a very different order than a lot of shows are mixed. I'll do the dialogue first, then the ADR, and then I'll put the score in. Mm. So it's a slightly different way of working, because that music's not going to go anywhere. You know, we want it in, and I'm not going to drop the strings to get the crows and the wind in trees through.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Is post-production mixing your primary job at the moment then, or primary role?
Yes, it is. I've obviously started in music in the studios, and I still do music. Mm. Got a publishing company with my business partner, Tom Allom, who's probably best known for being producer of bands like Judas Priest and such. And yeah, and he's brilliant to have as a business partner. Mm. And because my company, I think I mentioned earlier, went under due to COVID.
Yeah.
Hackenbacher went under, and so we regrouped and set up Sakuti Productions, which does post-production mixing and editing for telly and films, and also music work as well. So we have a publishing company that we can roll into things, which is good, and we're doing some lovely podcast work and some great digital work and some fantastic shows.
Yeah.
And a wonderful movie coming up, which I can't talk about, but it's brilliant to see this stuff being made again.
What,
you know?
Are you working on anything at the moment that you can talk about? Just what you got? What's the future
Not
hold?
Really. I'm just about to embark on a 10-month mix.
Wow. Yeah.
Which gives you an idea of what it is, and it's just great.
Mm.
It's really nice quality work, and it's great. We're very fortunate it's come our way. It's nice.
That's good.
And lovely clients, which is important.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know.
It's interesting what you were saying at the beginning about the careers advisor, because I told mine that I wanted to work in the music industry, and they gave me the leaflet about Our Price, which doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. So, same thing.
It's such a, I mean, I don't know what that job, the careers advisor role entails, but I feel like they need to go back and speak to themselves 20 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love teaching, and I was very well mentored.
Mm.
So, you know, we work with a lot of young people and try and bring them through in the correct way. Not just, you know, runner for life. And if you're lucky, you get you become head runner, which means, you know, a few extra quid and whatever. It's actually proper teaching.
Mm.
I like to think we do that well.
Yeah, I went back to my old college last year and did like a talk on obviously what I do. And it's not, they don't, especially like live OB stuff, they don't talk about that at college or university level. So it gave everybody a bit of an insight into sort of another thing you can do with all your knowledge about sound, because the music side of it, which people want to do, is such a small like gap that you can squeeze into this, but there's all these other roles you can do using your knowledge of sound.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I did in the beginning, you know, and still do is I slam together, you know, the stuff that I learned when I was doing music, and I still do music. So I bring that into post.
Mm.
And sometimes it all just blends together. And you know, a show like Killing Eve, for example, is almost treated as a piece of music.
Mm.
It really is. It really, really is. And certain bits of Downton too. It's all the same skills.
Yeah.
So it's nice. It's nice to mash them together.
Yeah.
It really is.
It is. And obviously having, you know, a musical background as well gives you that sort of sense of the feel of everything as well.
Yeah. I think it's important that, if you're working on a show that's got a lot of music in it, that everything else around the score is tuned and timed, and you know, so it sits together.
Yeah. No, the post production is something I've never really worked on and never done. So it's interesting to speak to somebody about it, because it's something that I've got no real knowledge about.
Yeah, and I've you know, done a bit of live stuff.
Mm.
You know. Worked on some of those big Jean-Michel Jarre concerts in France and in Paris, and one in London, which was a lot of years ago now. Princess Di was there.
Do you enjoy the music stuff?
Love it.
Yeah.
Absolutely love it. Yeah. And sometimes on shows, you know, I'll get through the dialogue and then slam myself into the music and I'll just close the door and get on with it and love it.
Yeah. I guess that's the point where it starts to take shape once you've got rid of like the dialogue, and it suddenly feels like you're putting things together then, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And our crew, you know, my brilliant assistant Stu, who's sitting behind me now making sure that I'm actually recording this and keeping an eagle eye. You know, he's a songwriter, got a great band called Mosaics. They're doing great.
Mm.
A couple of my other team members as well are musicians, DJs.
Mm.
It's a very musical company, and that's really, really nice, you know. And say that my partner, business partner Tom, with his kind of metal background, you know, Black Sabbath, Judas Priest,
brilliant.
it's a musical company, and that's great.
Yeah, great.
Love it.
Well, I'll thank you there, because I know you've got to get off and you've got a busy afternoon. So, but thank you very much for having a quick chat with me today. It's been great.
No problems. Thank you very much for asking me.
It's fine. I mean, like I say, I think you were maybe the second or third person I asked when I first came up with the idea, because I'd just listened to the podcast with Nish Kumar talking about it, and I was like,
"Oh, that wonderful bit where he says, what does he say? He said, I tell you why the title music sounds bad, because Nigel Heath had just got up and stamped all
over it. Something like that. Yeah. It's so nice to hear somebody talk about the sound on a podcast like that, because it sounds like the I can say this because I'm ginger, like the ginger stepchild of the TV industry. So you sort of, it's nice for people to recognize it.
Yeah, that niche quote was nice.
Yeah,
and that was nice to hear. So yes, I was stamping on the tape and eating it. I've calmed down now since things went digital.
How can you make this a bit of a hoodie on a computer sound like it's been stamped on? Well,
the hard drives don't taste so nice.
Massive thanks to Nigel there for spending the time and talking to me. As I said, he couldn't spare too much time because he's a very busy man. But if you are interested in Dark Place, it is on 4OD. It is well worth the watch if you're into surreal comedies, especially like the early 2000s stuff. And the rest of his back catalogue speaks for itself, so I don't need to go and tell you to watch Downton Abbey. Did anybody spot the April Fool that I tried to do on Instagram this week? I obviously didn't speak to the man who invented tone, but I did invent a backstory for him and would have loved to have done a proper April Fool's episode, but just didn't get around to it. Joining me on the next episode is Rob Ashard, who's going to be chatting with me about his career and his work in light entertainment. So until then, I'll see you later.